Welcome to episode 11 of The Zach Kuhn Show. My guests today, plural, are Morgan Hayduck and Andrew Beatty, the founders and CEOs of BeatDap. Now, you may be hearing a little bit about BeatDap, and you might not have any idea what it is, so I'm going to fill you in. Essentially, they're solving a $4 billion problem in the music industry. Get this, 15% of streams go unaccounted for every single year, and that results in $4 billion worth of lost income. Now, this is a pretty crazy task to take on head first, solving this problem, and this is exactly what BeatDap is doing. Essentially, they're like auditors for the music industry. As soon as I learned about this company, I was so fascinated by them. I knew I had to have them on the show. This is such a cool episode. I learned a ton about streaming and how auditing works and how, you know, royalty payments are made. So much information here. I can't wait for you guys to listen. Let's dive into it because I just want to get right into it. Let's go. Okay, we are live on the podcast. Andrew and Morgan, thanks so much for being here.
We're excited to be here. Thanks.
So this is so exciting because I've been following you guys for a minute, and just to catch everyone up really quickly on BeatDap, basically you guys are solving a $4 billion problem in the industry, and essentially you're auditing streams and DSPs. So you're making sure that stream count is accurate because you've stumbled upon this problem, which is about 15% of streams are unaccounted for, right? Correct me if I'm wrong. And yep, it turns out to be a $4 billion problem. How did you guys fall upon this problem? How did you find this was an issue in the industry?
Yeah, I think it largely goes to the fact that Morgan and I had kind of worked in and around the industry, myself on the artist side and promotional side, like helping launch artists, do a lot of ad support, tour support, promotions. Morgan working specifically on the copyright end, extending copyright protection for artists legally in Canada, went into act in 2015, I think. But effectively, they just trusted us. Like, we've known a lot of these people for, you know, 10, 15 years. We've always been, I would say, in the label advocate system. Like, we went on to build other tech companies, and, you know, this is not our first kind of rodeo. But I think that the reason is that they felt comfortable sharing is we've always felt like labels do 1,000 things to make an artist successful, and collecting and managing the royalty streams or auditing that is just one component, right? And so is a lot of these early tech companies come in and they kind of say, like, burn the whole house down, like, let's go artist to consumer, and like, all, everyone in the supply chain is bad. And, you know, we felt the opposite. We felt that everyone has their place in the supply chain for a reason, and we wanted to build something that would sort of help everyone along and not necessarily displace. So we aren't trying to disintermediate anybody. We actually would just like to be a kind of an add-on tool for everyone that exists. And so when the labels kind of knew, I think, that kind of cultural, like, perspective from our end, I think that after building relationships for 10 years, they felt comfortable sharing, hey, we've done a couple audits where we go in and pull the streaming, the server logs for how many times a song's been served, and it does not match the reports we're given. So the way it works today is, you know, a streaming service reports the numbers back. The label then invoices based on those numbers for their pro rata share. So if their artist did 100 million to 500 million plays, just simplifying this, they'll invoice for 20% of the eligible pool of money. But what happens if your artist actually did 120 million plays and you should have invoiced for 24% or whatever? So add up all those micro pennies across all your artists if you're a label, and you end up with millions and millions of dollars that have been misallocated or not collected on, which, even if you have everything downstream for who owns what part and how many pieces, like what goes to publishing and what goes to each one of these splits and who gets their cut, like whatever the cut is for the sound recording side, like all of that doesn't matter. As it all matters, but it, none of that impacts the fact that the base foundational number is still wrong, and that everyone downstream from that number has inadvertently been paid the incorrect amount. And that is something that we were surprised by. I guess Morgan and I both kind of stood in awe. Like, we were like, how is this possible? Like, kind of a little bit, like, what?
Yeah. And there's an element of, like, tale as old as time here too. Like, auditing and, you know, checking sort of distribution has always been a function of any like distributed economy, right? Like you go back to physical distribution days, there were different ways that labels would, you know, check to make sure that things were in the bins that they were supposed to be in retail, or that the, you know, pallets left the shipping, you know, facility. Like it's not really a knock on anyone in the supply chain. It's just sort of always existed. It's just, there hasn't been a way to do it in the digital context until now, short of, like to Andrew's point, physical, you know, server log level audits, which no one is really set up to do well. It's time consuming, it's expensive, and it doesn't make a ton of sense if you can do it proactively from the start.
Yeah, I mean, think about it. Like, if I'm an auditor, we've talked to numerous auditors. Like, your typical path would be you wait, your label, things take off. I mean, timing really worked in our favor too, because streaming kind of revitalized and changed the industry. Then the typical behavior pattern for a label is to audit every 2 or 3 years. So you go 2 or 3 years down this path, streaming now is making up a huge amount of your revenue, and you go, oh, we should audit them. So where do you go to? You go to the traditional audit sources who track money, not streams. So they get there. And what's crazy is, like, I know a couple of the people in that space fairly well. And one woman I know extremely well was like, yeah, we go in here and, like, we're not really sure what to do. They just data dump all this stuff on us. And we're just looking at it going, like, none of us are engineers. Like, we're going to have to call the accounting firm, ask for them to send us frontline engineers to figure this out. They have their engineers trying to figure out how to audit. Most times what they end up doing is just tracking the money and trying to find it from the subscriber and the revenue side instead of play count, because it's the fastest, easiest way for them to bill hours and for them to find a win-win where, like, the client's happy, they get out of the hair of the DSP and everyone moves on, and they don't actually necessarily go after the same root issue. So in a lot of ways, when we first started thinking, like, oh no, we might, you know, step on the toes, like kind of our concept of not disintermediating people, start talking to accounting firms, they would say, oh, actually this would be a godsend. Like, if we could just have receipts for every one of the play counts and then do what we do best, which is tracking the money, perfect situation. And so when you think about, there isn't something that exists to do that today until BDAP. And that's what's really cool about it, is that, you know, we're an insurance product. We make sure that you are paid correctly at the front end instead of waiting 3 years and settling for 10, 20 cents on the dollar or whatever it is, whatever you end up negotiating. You know, and it's pretty grueling for a DSP too. Like,
well, so why you would think that the DSPs should have this figured out. You would think every time a song is streamed, they should be able to track it. And I don't think that Spotify is that devious. I do not believe they are hiding these streams. How come for them it's so difficult to track each stream?
Yeah, they're not at all being malicious. Like, the right. Craziest part is that this is not, like, we're very supportive of the DSPs in our system, because, like, it's actually, they're trying to do the right thing. At the end of the day, there's so many opportunities for mistakes. So you have data transformation errors, like ETL scripts that break. You have data normalization from different platforms and different regions that don't aggregate together correctly. In one case, I literally walked into a DSP who didn't have the resources to continually update and build into their product reporting. They had 10 manual people aggregating reports on CSVs in a room, like manually pulling from different places, trying to make a report for a label. And this is a fairly decent sized DSP. And so it's interesting, because from their viewpoint, they're in it. If you aren't Spotify, Apple, Tencent, Pandora, and even amongst them, but if you're everybody else, even, you are fighting for market share. Like, you are trying to win users, you're trying to maintain or win in your niche, you're trying to maybe a specific, like, endemic style music. So maybe it's like Middle Eastern music, or in India, like Indian specific content. So
totally,
it's interesting, because they're so focused on winning their market and user growth, and reporting and being the best at reporting does not add one net new user. Like, if you're trying to survive and win a market, being the best at reporting out on something that happened is not at all, and likely shouldn't be your priority, if you want to live, right? And so
totally,
I think that's the issue. I think that it takes constant maintenance. It takes a lot of product and engineering support and resources. And in a lot of ways, you know, we can kind of absolve them. We can help them with that by coming in and saying, look, like everyone agrees to this count. You aren't going to be audited for server log stuff anymore. So you don't need to put frontline engineers there. Some of these, Morgan can tell you, some of these take up to like 18 months sometimes for an audit. So imagine having a frontline staff there, just not building anything, trying to work with, auditor. It's really expensive and time consuming. Like when we talk to some DSPs, they're like, look, if you could just remove this piece of the audit, amazing. like this is a huge headache. And in a lot of ways, the more successful they become, the harder that is, right? Because now they're trying to compete on different levels for different types of product features and releases. And then they have more and more and more labels willing to audit them because they're bigger.
Totally. Okay, wait, so you discover this problem and you go, okay, we can solve this and we're gonna do it on a blockchain. And you would maybe think out of the gate, okay, let's put this on Ethereum or, you know, what can we build this on? But the reality is that there's over like a trillion streams going down a year and you have to be able to catch all of them. Ethereum's too slow. So you guys go, we're gonna build our own protocol. Can you talk a little bit through how that decision was made and then how you guys were able to, you know, actually build a protocol? I know you have a lot of experience in the space, but it can't be that easy, right?
No, it's definitely not easy. And I think that we did not want to build a protocol at the start. Like our first sort of take at this was, let's see what the endpoints are going to be, because maybe we don't need to. So we actually built on Ethereum in the very beginning as a prototype to go back to the labels and say, is this what you're looking for as an endpoint? So like, let's just get the a basic version done that doesn't need to scale so that we can build what the client facing piece might look like. So we know, like just from typical product development, like, is this what you need? Get their feedback quickly so we don't make a wrong turn, because when you go to build something this substantial, it's a pretty big haul and you definitely don't want to be building the wrong direction. So
totally.
We got all that stuff figured out first. Then we kind of looked at each other and said, okay, this is kind of where like rubber meets the road here. Like we actually have to now build this protocol. And Morgan and I, self-funded for the first 15 months. We're really lucky that at my last company, I worked with, dozens of developers that were very well-versed in the blockchain space. We were building all kinds of apps on blockchain just for fun, like not even as our core business. So we built like wallets and crypto trading bots and coins and an Elo ranking system for foosball and like just all kinds of stuff. So what ends up happening after 2-3 years, you have these developers that are very, very good and well-versed in blockchain and different protocols and capabilities. And so then we went to the drawing board and Poria really led that, our third co-founder. He really led that front, just sort of, we knew we had to do 1 million transactions per region or there was no business. Like it per second per region. Sorry, good catch. So 1 million streams per second per region. Regions are obviously broke up globally. So it ends up being able to do 1 trillion streams. And without that, there's no business here. Like there's no way
totally
to do it. So
the technical bar was the very first thing we knew we had to clear. And it's also the reason, to Andrew's point, that we stayed quiet for 15 months and sort of self-funded and just built the technology, because we knew, the market dynamic is a completely separate conversation, but table stakes is, can your tech support the market you're trying to enter? And in our case, it's like the back of the envelope is actually pretty easy. The big numbers are out there, 1.15 trillion streams in North America this year. So you have to get up into those like sort of 7-digit per second throughput rates before you're going to have a chance to say, and here's why this makes sense in this market.
I think a lot of startups do the opposite. They come out with this big idea, this theoretical broad strokes. We're going to change the world. This is what's going to happen. I think Morgan and I are more pragmatic. We've been through a few startups and honestly, like, I don't know if Morgan could speak, but real talk, I wasn't going to risk my reputation just as a a growth executive or an entrepreneur on something I wasn't sure could actually stand up. So, you're asking, it sounds dumb, but you're asking a lot. Like we're leaving executive positions to go full time on this thing. I'm looking at it like a VC. I've done a lot of investments myself. I look at this and say, okay, is the market potentially there? Is there a strategy there? Do you have line of sight on how this might roll out? What does the timeline look like? What are the business economics? Is this worth building? Because you could put your energy into 17 different things. Is this the one you want to pick to actually build on? And is it worth actually leaving a job where you make a good amount of money and make peanuts? And are you going to be happy and satisfied with that? And I think
Through the dip here?
Yeah, exactly. And is it something you're going to want to do? So there's all this vetting that goes through your mind as an entrepreneur that anyone should do. I think it's easier to do when you're younger. Like when I think about my younger, I've had a few companies. When I think about the younger ones, I would just kind of jump in excited about an idea. I think as I got older, I started evaluating like what that idea looks like at scale and like what the effort is, because I could put the same amount of energy into building a coffee shop as I might put into like building an application. I'm like all in, living and breathing in the coffee shop, doing all those things. And if you're not passionate about that being your lifestyle business, like you're not gonna get rich at the coffee shop, right? So I think you have to decide what you want out of this and what, like if it's gonna work. Like I last thing I wanna do, a lot of times in startups too, and Morgan, I don't know how you feel, but maybe you've interviewed a lot of people, but I kind of feel like you're only as good as your last project. Kind of like they say, like you're only as good as your last haircut. Like I don't want to just like jump in on something and look crazy wrong, you know. Like that was my biggest fear at the beginning, was is there an actual market, can I validate with this other labels, can we get through the technical pieces, are we going to be able to fundraise so you can do it properly? Because in my experience, an underfunded project is actually more dangerous often than an overfunded project. So it's like if you don't have the resources and you're constantly just fundraising, you don't get a chance to build. And so there was this sort of like all these kind of critical elements that Morgan and I discussed that needed to be in place in order for us to say go. And, you know, being out there publicly announcing it all does no good on that front, you know, like from that perspective. So Morgan, what do you think?
Totally.
Oh man, it got a little philosophical.
I like this. Bring on the philosophical.
Yeah. No, you know what it got me thinking about, aside from like the philosophy of building companies and why you start them and, you know, what gets you up in the morning. There was also some questions we asked ourselves at the beginning about the technology, and like Andrew will joke all the time that he was the sort of weird crypto friend, and that's true. But we came into this not necessarily like married to blockchain as the tech. We sort of came into it thinking, you know, we had a sense of the problem, and we had a sense that trust, you know, between all of these sort of stakeholders was central to the, you know, the need for a product. And we sort of got to ride on a couple of, I think, really established coattails. There are some people in the industry who for 5 years have been sort of talking about the value of the blockchain technology itself, not ICOs, not tokenization, not, you know, the currencies, but actually fundamentally why a distributed ledger makes sense to solve certain sort of niche problems. And that was part of our sort of, you know, to Andrew's point, the strategy of thinking through how we were going to build this company was we identified tech that solved a problem where trust was at the center of the problem. And that was kind of a cool thought experiment as well, right? Because there are lots of different ways that you could tackle this. You know, Deloitte tackles it in a very different way in a retroactive audit than we do. But we sort of got to, you know, have the philosophical conversation about like, well, what are the dynamics that exist in the industry that, you know, require a solution like this to exist? And is there technology available that like at its core solves that problem and makes everybody feel comfortable, builds consensus, whatever you want to call it. And that was cool because it let us, you know, build on technology that we really believe in and sort of put all of the like marketing hype of like blockchain and cryptocurrency on a shelf and just say like, at its core, this technology actually makes a ton of sense at this very narrow intersection of usage reporting and royalty collection.
Totally. I mean, I've always sort of thought that, you know, like a couple of years ago, obviously blockchain was all the rage. Yeah. And I always kind of felt like when people stop talking about blockchain, that's when we'll know that it's actually in place or when it's actually working.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
Similarly with BeatDap, how will we know that it's there? Like what are you guys going to judge success by? Like now BeatDap is in the news and you're adding, you know, kick-ass advisory board members and you can read about you in Billboard. How will we know that BeatDap has actually arrived and the industry has fully embraced it?
I think from our perspective, it's about accuracy. We've always strived to be the source of truth. And to that point, we never took any kind of you know, industry or strategic investment. All of our money has come from general investors or people outside the music industry, so that we were never perceived to be one direction or the other. And we've always thought to ourselves is, okay, we add value for labels. How do we add value for DSPs? How do we fight streaming fraud? How do we help them so that it's equally valuable for both sides of this equation? And how do we stay neutral? So I think for me, the ultimate success is two factors. One, the percentage of the DSPs that we cover. So how many DSPs can we get on board? Can we have coverage over, let's say, 90 or 95% of a label's revenue from, you know, hundreds of DSPs? Because it's easy to see the first five, but there's hundreds of long tail DSPs. So how do you make this viable and a positive, you know, impact, and really just the majority of, you know, the power law of at least 80% of a label's revenue? And that requires some coverage. So coverage one, and two, accuracy. Like being able to prove when you turn this on, you turn it on for 3 months and you say, here's your report, here's the verified stream counts right next to it. Like there is a receipt for every single time you hit play, the streaming service, the label, and our nodes are saying, yes, we recognize this is Morgan playing a song. He's met all this play count conditions. So he's listened to at least 30 seconds, let's say, if that's a condition. It's blah, blah, blah. There's like a bunch of these line items. Once they've occurred, they all literally cryptographically sign it. You have a signature on every single receipt. So it's pretty nice to be able to say, hey, your system was, you know, set a million, but we have receipts for 120 million that count financially towards play counts. We'd like to reconcile this now, not 3 years from now. Like, let's fix the invoice now at that point. So for me, it's about accuracy and coverage. Those are the two kind of, that's when you know we've made it. And I think the other point is that we try really hard not to talk about blockchain. It's really interesting. Like, we don't really enjoy going to blockchain conferences. Like, I've been in this space since 2012, like Bitcoin mining first, and then crypto trading bots and investing and stuff like that. So I've been in and around the space a long time. I don't really buy all the hype. Like, I've always felt like blockchain is just another tool. It's like describing to somebody that you've built a website for you to sell something. Like, to me, it's just like part of your tool stack that's there to accomplish a goal. And to Morgan's point, like, trust is the primary piece that really blockchain thrives in. When there's a lack of trust, blockchain helps people participate trustlessly but still maintain their privacy. And so that's kind of where I just think that it just is. And the less we talk about blockchain and more about accuracy and solving the problem, the better, because that's ultimately what we're doing. Like, our business is to solve this core problem, not to build a blockchain tool, not to build more blockchain tools, not to take our blockchain and go sell it to other tools. Like, we built it because we had to solve a very specific problem for music.
Totally. So historically, the music industry hates embracing new technology. You know, they're always the last ones to get on board. And while this technology seems to make so much sense, who knows what the music industry is going to think of, you know, change and something new. Is that something that you guys have seen any pushback on, or how do you guys hope to, you know, overcome that sort of stigma that the industry has?
I'd be willing to, like, make a little bit of a counter argument for in defense of the music industry as tech adopters, that, you know, save for the, like, very high profile sort of Napster example and period, technology and the music industry have sort of moved along quite nicely from different forms of, you know, distribution or different forms of how you actually play a song, like going from, you know, vinyl to CD. Like, those are all the examples of the industry embracing technology and using it to their advantage. And I think there's a certain resilience that maybe the industry as a whole doesn't get enough credit for, because there's the Napster example that everyone likes to cite off the top. But short of that, like, the industry does actually have a decent track record of adopting new tech. But I think this goes back to something we said early on. If you're going to introduce new technology, introduce it in a way that, you know, is accretive to the industry, not as we're going to disintermediate some existing entrenched stakeholder. Because I think a lot of, like, the resilience comes from the fact that labels, distribution, and artists make up a pretty stable three-legged stool. And if you come in and try to cut one of those legs out because you have some shiny new technology, good luck, I think. So we look at it like, yes, the technology is novel. The problem is not. But let's not take it to the industry and say, like, look, we've got a new idea for how to completely revolutionize the industry and, you know, blockchain for everything. It's not that. It's like, you guys have a, if the problem was we need to dig a hole and we came along and said, like, we've got a shovel, that would make a lot of sense. That's sort of the same way we think about this, right? Like, there's a thing that we would like to solve for. We have the technology that does it. but it's not going to upset the apple cart in any sort of meaningful way. And I think that was sort of core to our strategy. It was always like, come at it from a place of, you know, we think we understand a lot of the dynamics between stakeholders, and we're not trying to say that like tech is the solve for everything. Anyway, off my soapbox for a second, but I just think that generally the history of the music industry and tech is like maybe a little more favorable than it gets credit for. And so we're hoping that that sort of comes through again in this instance for BeatDAO.
And in a lot of ways, maybe they don't want to make the same, like Napster will haunt the music industry forever. And so I feel like in a lot of ways, you kind of swing the other direction. Like look at the amount of innovation funds that have come out of, labels that probably didn't exist before. Look at all of these like tech first focused viewing. For any organization, it takes time to get through. Like it's notorious in the music industry, it takes forever to get deals done. Like that's fine. That's just enterprise sales 101 anyway. So it's like kind of how it works. But it is interesting that they are proactively trying to find new tech and see what they could implement. And in a lot of ways, Napster, in my opinion, kind of created this pendulum swing where they just don't want that ever to happen again. So they've kind of gone the other direction as well. And kind of, you know, supporting what Morgan said, I really do think that that's probably helpful. Like timing is everything. That's probably helpful in our case right now. We kind of hit that time frame where streaming takes off. It hasn't been regulated necessarily as well as some people would like. There's not a lot of accountability, and to one of our advisors always says now there's more money to be made over the top of the table than under it. Like streaming has taken off so much that it's kind of that time and we're in the right place.
That's a good, there's a point on regulation, not to like dive too deep into the my past life as a lobbyist, but if the Goldman Sachs folks are correct, and it seems like their sort of projections for the industry are holding up, and we're going to be at a $75 billion market in 2030 in streaming, which is crazy to think about. Like that's
totally
like 12% compound growth rate year on year. That's incredible. But if that's right, and it is going to be a $75 billion recorded music market just in streaming, the incentives to start thinking about how you regulate that market start to come into play. Like when it's a couple billion dollars, no regulator, no industry stakeholders are thinking about like, how do we level the playing field and make sure that there's sort of more accountability across the board. When you're $75 billion, people start thinking that. And so there's been some, you know, and there's been conversations about this in other jurisdictions. I think the EU is probably a leader in the space. But one of the points that I would make to the industry writ large is like, you kind of have two options when you get big. You either find a way to self-regulate and have everybody play by the same set of rules that you impose on yourself, or somebody comes over the top in a more ham-fisted way and bludgeons you with like the hammer of regulation. And if I'm the music industry, I'm looking at, you know, what the advertising industry has done with the IAB as a model to say, look, we can be effective working together and, you know, find ways to build consensus that doesn't require a third party state actor coming in and telling us how to administer, you know, whether it's like recognizing revenue or reconciling royalties or anything. It's just, we can do this ourselves. And we sort of see ourselves as a tool that fits nicely into that view of the world, which is come together as an industry, use technology to sort of be accountable to one another and avoid having, you know, your own version of, you know, some regulatory body come over the top and say, this is how you have to behave going forward. Because the cost of doing that, if you're a DSP or a label, is usually much higher than, you know, the sort of self-imposed version of that.
Hey everyone, thanks for listening and hope you're enjoying the show. Some of you may know that I run an industry newsletter called the Nashville Briefing. It really takes you to the front row of everything happening in our industry. And if you want to learn more about it, you can go to nashvillebriefing.com to subscribe. Also, if you're enjoying this show and specifically this episode, please feel free to give us a 5-star review on your podcast listening platform. Thanks so much. Now back to the show.
So you guys are both titled, you know, co-CEOs, co-founders at the company. I'm a little curious how you guys met and how you guys, you know, teamed up for this project. And also, I'm sure that's like balancing a good marriage or like any good relationship. Do you guys focus on different aspects? How do you split up the duty and, you know, interact together as co-CEOs?
Yeah, I mean, I think the marriage analogy is spot on. I don't know.
In a lot of ways, I'm a male version of his actual wife, so it's kind of interesting.
If she hears this, sorry.
And in a lot of ways, he's actually a male version of my wife. We met in grad school almost 10 years ago. We've been friends for a long time. We've worked on a lot of projects together. We were on during our MBAs, we were on a traveling selected case team for case competitions and stuff like that at different universities. We've worked in a lot of different verticals consulting on stuff together. So, and I think that's kind of just, it's interesting, but we've sort of been in a lifelong startup for 10 years. Like we've always been working on something kind of together, not normally with the goal of building a business, more like, hey, we're both interested in this, let's build this, or hey, we're going to help our friend out that's doing this, like, let's go use our resources. So there's just been a lot of working together constantly. And then in the initial phases, I would say I was much more involved in the actual product piece of it, because that's just a lot more of my background, building things at the very start. And then I think Morgan and I really worked heavily on the strategy side of things. Now the reality is we just have so much stuff coming at us, like the amount of labels that are reaching out and DSPs and everything. Like, to be honest, Morgan and I kind of just tackle things together where it comes in like a fire hose. And I'm like, you got these four, I got these four. He's like, I'll take this too, you take those two. And we just sort of both speak for the company and move quickly. And I think that that's kind of, I think in the future, there'll probably be some sort of designated roles like this. But as of right now, there's just so much coming at everybody. There's not really a problem. Cause we're always overwhelmed with just opportunities and people reaching us, and and there's a trust that's built over 10 years of working with Morgan that honestly, I know high levels, three or four things he's working on right now. I have zero idea what the details are. I'm fully confident they'll be solid. So I'm not thinking about it. I'm sometimes it keys you on in this meeting. I'm like, nah, man, just send me the notes. It's cool.
Yeah. If you get the opportunity to pick your co-founder, I think there's probably entire books written on whether you should pick a friend or not. And I will argue to my death that picking a friend is a good idea, because you just have so much shared history and banter and comfort. To me, founder relationships, and I would say this extends to Poria as well, require a lot of elasticity. And I think the way that you develop elasticity between people in a sort of pressure cooker environment is having some shared history. And so for us, we know each other's strengths and we sort of step in to complement each other where we need to, but also are totally comfortable running in totally different directions and then just getting back together to share what we've done. And I don't know that you get to that place where you're that comfortable if you also just sort of are getting to know each other on an interpersonal level as you're building the business. And so that to me has been sort of one of the many blessings of knowing your co-founders as you go into something, is it just gives you some latitude to take the things that you're, to know the things you're strong at, know the things that they have strengths and
work
pretty effectively together.
Bluntness. There's definitely let's not sugarcoat it. Morgan and I have had some we've had some all out things, but the reality is it's kind of being mad at your mom or your dad or your brother or your wife. At the end of the day, you just figure it out. It's better. We always, and one of our core values is really about saying something and the courage to say things. And so when there's a problem, I do my best, and I know Morgan does his best, not to let it fester. And what ends up happening is we just straight up bring it up, and we encourage all the employees. If the employees are feeling bad about stuff, we want them to say something. We actually champion that, because we want everything on the table in a closed door environment. Don't go publicly. No one publicly trash talks anybody. We don't do that kind of stuff. But bring it up. Let's have the adult conversation about it and find a path forward. Don't bury that feeling or animosity or even if you're right or wrong, like, you're entitled to have feelings. Even if you feel like there's no reason that you should have the feeling, you still have the feeling. Like, just
right, totally.
You know, I'll call Morgan and be like, "Look, you didn't do anything wrong, but I still feel like this, and I'm mad." And he's just like,
"It's not wrong. I don't know what to tell you."
Yeah, and he's like,
"I don't know.
Go sleep it off, bud." Like, you know, we just have those kinds of real conversations that I don't think you can have, or you don't feel comfortable having with people you don't know well. And I think that that's kind of been really helpful for us. And same with the tech, like with Poria. He'll come to me and say, from a business perspective, like, I've done a lot of like developers. I've had a lot of developers report back to me, or manage a lot of developers and build a lot of product. I've learned really early on, it's not in my best interest to, like, you know, micromanage their coding or how they're going to do tickets or whatever. Poria is another one of those brilliant minds who, if I say, this is what I'm trying to build and this is the car, I go, "Hey, here's the car I've sketched out. It's like a Ford Fusion." And he comes back with a Tesla. And I'm like, sick. Like, I don't, you know, like, I can't do his job. He's so good at that and brilliant. And I just need to tell him what we're using the car for, so he builds the best version of that thing, you know? And like,
totally.
And I think there's like that kind of relationship. And that comes from years of working with somebody, I think, or knowing them, to Morgan's point too. And I don't know how I've never been able to successfully, or I've had less success manufacturing that short term when you're first getting in a startup, because there's just so much pressure from investors, pressure from partners, pressure from your team, pressure from hiring new employees,
from your real wives.
That also.
And just like the pendulum of startup emotions. Like, I think someone said, you know, it just swings from like, exuberance to despair or something like that on a daily basis. Like, that's the emotional range is,
totally.
Yeah. And so if you're just constantly sort of in that back and forth, it's nice to just be sort of grounded in like at least the core early relationships before thing. At some point you become a business and you have people who work on communications and people who work on human resources and people who work on product and people who sell things. And like, all of those jobs are super important. But when you get big enough that you start having like sort of more narrow verticals, there's also some like formality and process and procedure that comes with that. In the early days, you're just, you know, trying to bottle lightning. So a little less structure and pays to have, you know, pretty deep well of, you know, relational capital with the people that you're in the trenches with.
And to a lot of extent, Morgan's the perfect fit for that with me, because like, Morgan is like, "Hey, we should document that." I'm running, bottling lightning. I'm out there bottling lightning, running in circles. And Morgan's like, "Hey, ground that. It's like, you know, it's, and then Morgan's out there and I'm like, go faster. And so like, we're constantly just pushing each other in all the best ways, if that makes sense.
Totally.
And that's kind of, it's nice to know that you're not, if you miss something, there's somebody that's equal to you that might catch it.
So you had mentioned it earlier, and you know, I think at the beginning of quarantine and COVID, the streaming reports were kind of interesting. It said streaming was down. Then it showed that maybe wasn't the case, and streaming's kind of leveled off. It's higher than it is. It's sort of like, I feel like we're getting different reports, you know, on what the actual streaming numbers are during this pandemic. But has this pandemic, is this gonna, you know, jetpack beat DAP, or is this helping you guys? Has this made you guys regroup? How has the pandemic sort of affected the progress of what you guys are working on?
I see three things that make sense to me right off the bat from that question. One, this undertow of like what is happening with streaming. So I'll address that first. I do think streaming numbers are down by volume of like actual just listening. I think there's a lot of people that listen on the way to work or listen in other types of environments when they're commuting. I think there's a good percentage that have just dropped in terms of usage of listening or potentially pivoted into like podcasts or whatever. So I think that there's that element, but subscription numbers are up. So in terms of revenue, like, you have this undertow of subscribers, which in interactive streaming is kind of the important metric. So I think what you see is in COVID, almost like, I think of it like technical analysis for in TA, when you do TA for investments, you're looking at for an angle, and they typically, like, what you have is this sort of underlying, you know, moving average. And then you have where the number, where like the stock price is or the price is. And at some point it forces it to take the jump, right? And when those lines cross, and that's kind of what I see happening here. Like, you see like maybe usage is slightly down and subscriber numbers are up, but people haven't been going to work. So if that's all working, what I think you have is this massive undertow that is going to just like propel the industry as soon as everything breaks back to normal. And I like in terms of streaming numbers. And I think that that's kind of the undercurrent that you wouldn't normally, that you aren't seeing yet on the top line number, but I think is definitely there. That's sure. My opinion. And then in terms of like COVID related to our business, we're lucky, like Morgan and I specifically, and you know, we traveled so much. Like I traveled 10 months last year. So in a lot of ways I've been remote forever. But for once, like instead of a label exec or a DSP saying, come meet me at this place next week or this 2 weeks from, like, instead of having to physically be there, they're on Zoom now. So it's like kind of crazy because things that we used to have to plan, okay, we're going to be in London, then we'll go to Paris, then we'll be in Nashville, then we'll be in New York. And like, we're planning out our travel schedule to have the next meetings with all of these partners. And then suddenly you can have them all in the same week and it doesn't matter. And like now things have gone faster, you know, and that's kind of, and I know Morgan has some views on just how live has been affected and how much that impacts us too. So,
well, I mean, I think you put a lot more emphasis on streaming and, you know, ensuring that everything is, you know, right off the top. If your live business, unfortunately, is down and potentially not coming back for a little while, Music Canada, which is a former client, did a survey earlier in sort of, I think, March or April about Canadian attitudes towards the live business. And I think it was like 40% of Canadians, which is probably reflective of American views as well, said they wouldn't attend a live event until there was a vaccine for the coronavirus.
Right.
And that's a pretty staggering number. So in the near term, I think streaming is, there's just going to be a bit more of a microscope on it. And then I think there's like the sort of non-COVID, but just sort of market sort of features that are interesting. So like if the golden stuff is going to be right, one of the things that has to be true is, you know, a market like India has to become a huge driver of revenue.
Totally.
So this isn't a COVID point, but it is like a streaming market point, which is like in the next 3 to 5 years, there should be a bigger digitized population in India than currently exists in the entire OECD. So of like the whatever 35 or 40 countries in the OECD, India's middle like digitized population will be bigger than that. Those people have to start streaming, and also they have to figure out the financial model that makes sense in that market. And so we look at the world, like there's this sort of, I think, North American impact of COVID and what that's done to commuters and people who listen to podcasts and all the other sort of streaming related things. And then there's like the big macro chessboard pieces, like what happens in emerging economies over the next 3 to 5 years, and how do we also work, you know, work in those markets and get in early. Because we're going to like, we will recover. I hope, I pray we'll recover from the pandemic and that things will get back to some like sort of new version of life, with hopefully more hand washing. But otherwise, like, you know, the rest of the, like the way we think about the world can't really change dramatically, right? Like we need these markets to come online and we need to win those markets as well. So I think like near term COVID has a real meaningful impact. Long term, the sort of fundamentals of, you know, the things that have to be true for streaming to reach that $75 billion number, they have to happen irrespective of what's going on, you know, in the world.
Totally. Any pinch me moments along the BeatDap ride? I know you guys are big music fans. I know, Andrew, you're a big Slash fan. Morgan, your first concert was Garth Brooks. Like any moments with some, you know, celebrities or anything fun that you're like, holy crap, you know, my 15-year-old self never would have believed I'd be in this room.
So
a few.
There, what, like, I was also going to point out, Garth Brooks was also my first concert.
Was he? My goodness.
Yeah. Yeah. I grew up.
I got fire sword on the research huge team. My God.
Yeah. No, that's Morgan and I bond on this all the time. And sorry for every other artist that might hear this, but Garth Brooks is 100% my favorite artist. He's like, Morgan and I bond on that all the time. It honestly, like, he is. In some ways, we joke that one day we hope to work with him so that we could have built BeatDap just to work with Garth Brooks. like we love Garth Brooks. Anyway, so it's a magical moment. Like, you know, it's weird to be a kid going to a Garth Brooks concert and then think that you might do something that could help musicians and like how that inspires you. And, you know, Morgan has crazy stories from that are stuff like that. But, you know, that's, yeah, it's a... Sorry, I got diverted there, but special place in my heart.
Totally.
I mean, I think even just on the folks. So there are a couple meetings that I wish we were allowed to say because I would like there are a couple of pinch me moments that I still when I like, you know, think about at the end of the day, like, holy man, I can't believe this is real. Unfortunately, they're also still sort of in the financial realm. But even just I think about like the folks that we're fortunate enough to call advisors. Like you mentioned earlier that we've built a pretty killer board, and I think that's true. And you know, you think about the stories of almost every like, to a person that group. Like it's surreal to me that we get to work with them every day. It's surreal to me that you know next time you watch Straight Outta Compton, like Brian Turner's in that movie, and now we talk to him all the time. Joe Galante, like the man who taught Nashville how to sell records. That is crazy.
We had Joe on the podcast a couple months ago, and I mean, he's the best. He's unbelievable. He lives up to everything. He's incredible.
Yeah, and I mean, that stuff, I think, you know, those
even
are also
the prime minister. Pinch me moment for me is I went to India with the former prime minister of Canada. He was like, oh, let me introduce you. He like, I went with him to do a private presidential tour of the palace, met all the ministers. The pinch me moment was riding in his motorcade from meeting to meeting in the backseat with the former prime minister thinking like, I'm in India right now, going to meet foreign heads of state in a bulletproof Suburban. Like, it's just like for BTAP. Like, this is just like crazy to me. And it's like,
totally.
It's like a weird, like, I could never, if you'd asked me 2 years ago, not a chance. Like, we're like, this is crazy. Like, you know, those kinds of, that's like, it's insane. Like, to work with these people every day and be able to text them and call them and ask their advice and say, and all of them, like not just a name on a deck, like no one on our advisor board is just there. They all have a very specific focus, lane, initiative they're working on to push BTAP. We have regular meetings where we treat them very much like our board, where we give out packages ahead of time. You know, we have discussed very narrowly focused things. Like here's the three topics we need to dive deep on. And everyone sort of just, you know, takes a role and says, okay, I'm going to do this, do this, do this, do this. And then they all work on that. And it's like having a very powerful extension of your team that is
totally.
Very knowledgeable and helps protect us and protect our downside, you know, constantly.
Totally. Okay, I'll close out here. You guys both have books behind you. Always a good move on the Zoom call. Any good startup books or books or just any recommendations that you're reading right now or that you've always loved, some of your favorite books?
I'd also like to point out on the shelf, there's a family size pack of Kraft Dinner.
That's good.
Appear to be at least 6 bottles of some sort of balsamic glaze. So this is truly, like, if anyone's ever wondering if this was taped during the pandemic, it was. The provisions are on the shelf behind us to prove it.
It will forever be a relic from the pandemic.
Yeah. I read Rockonomics right when it came out. I thought it was great. Just concise, the lens through which he looks at the industry is you know, pretty powerful. I'd recommend Rockonomics and probably Hitmen to anybody in the music industry who haven't read those books, but that's like basically saying like, you know, fish swim in water. I'm reading a book right now called Range.
I'm reading it also actually like right now. Fascinating. Yeah.
Great. Right. David Epstein, I'll say this just because I think like there's no way that either of these people will ever like, you know, if they hear this, I'm sorry in advance. David Epstein is like if Malcolm Gladwell just read all the source material, because he goes so deep on everything and it's awesome because like every sentence is its own rich researched point. And I just feel like you get a ton from his books. Like,
his point about how like everyone who's won a Nobel Prize or like a large percentage of people who've won Nobel Prizes are I think it's like 30% likely or something to either play music, do magic, sing, dance, like have some other side thing. There's so many nuggets like that are fascinating in that book. You try to remember them all.
It's great. I mean, I think it makes a point about, you know, how you value your own sort of individual skill set. Like it gives you some perspective that the things that you think of as, you know, maybe the things you just do for fun or maybe the things you do for free because you're just passionate about them actually have a pretty high chance of transferring into the thing that, you know, you get paid to do if you're just willing to look at it from that wider perspective as opposed to like, I am very narrowly an expert in this domain, and I don't pull anything in from, you know, beyond the sort of narrow expertise that I have.
Is there something that you've looked back in your life and you've been like, that was a random side thing that I did that now is helping me with
everything. Like, cryptocurrency building, I heard about Bitcoin from a guy that was writing his paper on Anonymous in the apartment above me. And it's like, I'm like, what is Bitcoin? And he's using all his money for labs. And then you go down this spiral, like, you could mine this? How do you mine Bitcoin? You get so far, and then you're just like, now I have a blockchain company. It's kind of crazy. It's a side hustle that turns into something. And I encourage it all the time. I've mentored so many different startups and, because I've grown a number of startups, raised a ton of money for different companies. And I've always tried to encourage people to have a side hustle because you're constantly learning. If you have to not necessarily a side hustle for a business, but you're building this toolbox of tools, and you never know when the opportunity will arise for you to be able to need that tool and recognize that's the right tool for that specific problem. And I think the more of these kinds of little things you do, like learning to do a podcast or learning to, manage your social media content or trying to do growth hacks on things or build video content or whatever it is, you're going to learn something by doing it. And I think that those learnings often then become applied in whatever you do in the future as a business. And I think that's the fastest way. And we try to hire employees that really think that way and are constantly building things and executing on creative ideas they have, even if it's just a hobby. Yeah,
totally. Okay, Morgan, we got the book review from you. Andrew, let's hear it.
My favorite book that I think holds up, and by the way, my favorite book, I do not read a lot. So I read a lot of blogs, less books.
The bookshelves behind are deceiving, yeah. My goodness.
No, well, I mean, you read a lot in your MBA. You still read. I mean, I tell my wife I don't read that much, and she says, you're always reading. So I don't know. But I feel like I don't read enough. But my favorite book is by Tony Hsieh from Zappos, and it's called Delivering Happiness. And it's an older book. I think it's probably 10 plus years old. But Tony Hsieh really changed my opinion on the way that culture is run and that cultures take place inside of a company. And so early in my career, I did not care. Like, to me, culture was like drinking with people and partying. Like, that's basically my culture. And then I think that, I had the opportunity to meet Tony Hsieh and work with Zappos a little bit. And this was 2010, 11. And I think that it fundamentally changed my mind about what a good company culture looks like and about transparency and culture. And I really loved how he did this culture book where people could say what they didn't like about the company anonymously, which forced managers to then take notice of it and take action so that the next year when the culture book came out, ideally you had this progression of the company getting stronger and stronger and stronger. And people drinking the Kool-Aid more and more and more because it became a better and better place to live and work and participate.
Totally.
And have friends. And even things that they do internally, when I was talking to them about, hey, for example, I noticed their hallways were the hallways were a bit narrow. Now this is, post-COVID era, not great, but in pre-COVID era, pretty smart. You start thinking about, well, people aren't communicating as well. So they launched an internal tool where it asks you a random idea ask you a random question about someone in the organization. So what is Morgan's daughter's pet name? You have to go, oh, I don't know. So then everyone's running up to Morgan asking Morgan, what's your daughter's pet? Dog? Is it a dog? What's its name? And you're just asking. And so what ends up happening is then there's these points. Every day they get a new employee and a fact that you should know about them. And you try to guess. And the person who wins or earns the most points a month gets really cool gifts or surprises, trips, places, and encourages everyone to get to know each other on a personal level, not on a work level. And they took that one step further by actually making the corridors where you go through, pass through doorways narrow. So what ends up happening is you're forced into communication with people. So instead of being able to walk in a wide, high hallway or a big open space where you can avoid contact, it forces people to engage with each other as they're passing and talk and facilitate that interaction. And I thought that was so interesting how he took a physical environment and crafted it to build culture for Zappos as a whole. And a lot of things that I've now done since that point, I call it like culture in a box. Like there's certain things I do that I like to implement at every company moving forward. One of them is like a culture book where, and that's what Morgan and I and Foria started day one. We started taking pictures from the very first, like literally the very first meeting we had where we were drawing on a whiteboard of how this might look. We took photos. We take photos and videos and everything and catalog the journey. And we create these culture books every year where all the employees sign them and write notes to each other. And it's like this really amazing sort of artifact of our company for that year, good and bad, of what's occurred and what we've gone through. And I just think like just our company culture is one that it's hard for me to explain because it's just all action and less words. And like we do things like cheers where people like write each other anonymous comments about things they did for the week. And then we all read them out loud anonymously and you know, cheers to each other on Fridays. There's just like little things that we do at, we've picked up along the way that we've implemented at every into this company. And I think that really, when I think back to it, starts at delivering happiness and Tony Hsieh and how much that fundamentally changed my viewpoint of tech culture and culture in general for an organization.
Totally. Well, guys, thank you so much for taking the time to come on. This was so fun. And like I said, I've been following you guys for a minute and I can't wait to see where the company goes and how you guys integrate yourself in the music industry, because it feels like it's going to happen. Get on board with BTAP now, you know, don't fall behind. So thank you so much for taking the time and I hope you guys are staying well and hope we get the chance to say hello in person whenever we get the opportunity.
Likewise, awesome. Zach. Thank you for having us. This has been awesome.
Yeah. Thanks, absolutely, man. It's been great.
Talk to you guys soon. Stay well.
Thanks again for tuning in, and thanks again to Andrew and Morgan for taking the time to talk with us. So much fun. I'm so excited to keep following their journey. Hope you guys do the same. The Zach Kuhn Show is mixed by Sam Heyman, and our theme music is by Justin Johnson. If you want more content from us, you can subscribe to our newsletter at nashvillebriefing.com, or you can follow us on socials, everything at Nashville Briefing. Thanks again for tuning in, and we'll see you next week. Bye.